Well, welcome back. More good stuff. Some of the stuff we'll look at very closely. Some of it we'll go through quickly because it kind of repeats and it kind of goes on and on. And some of it I don't understand, so we'll have to work on together. Or I kind of understand it. What we did up to now was look at his beating himself up. That is always the case, that you get... I don't know when here does that. You get the vision of what you're capable of, and you compare where you are with what you're capable of. And it's a shock. The first reaction is to criticize yourself for not being where you can be, rather than understanding you have to start where you are to get to where you can be. But, and I'm not sure it's totally bad to beat yourself up. It should be within limits, but that can also be the pressure to achieve what you're capable of achieving. So then we hear the war broke out, so finally he's realizing what he's dealing with. And then he starts talking about communicating or sharing what he's just learned. And then we get into this thing which we'll see going back and forth for quite a few pages. What is it to give? Is it always good to give? That'll be something that he talks about quite a while. And then to begin answering that question, he starts talking about the self, which is on, we stopped at the paragraph beginning, the God appears to us, on 2 Chronicles 3:38. Now, what is so hard about this section, I think, is we're getting the final viewpoint of Jung on the self in bits and pieces, and they're contradictory, because the nature of the self is contradictory. So I thought what I would do is I would just give start with a very brief description of where he's going, ultimately. Now, he's not anywhere near that yet. I think that will help put all the pieces in perspective, because it's a complete mess of contradictory statements, because he doesn't have the bigger picture to resolve all those contradictions. And I think it might help if I diagram a little bit. The basic idea, I know some of you have heard this, just bear with me. Is that the ego is contained in the self. In a child. That's why they're so damn charming. But of course, you gotta feed them, you gotta poop them and everything else. What's the self? Well, it's a mystery. It's a process. But I, at the risk of oversimplifying, think it's fair to start saying the self is your identity. It's who you are. It's also the process by which who you are comes into being. But just for the sake of simplicity, think of it as the portrait of your individual personality, your individual talent, individual strengths, and so on. That's putting it at its center. So a child is all potential. Well, as development occurs, the ego and the self have to separate. Probably not as strongly as our education system demands it. But, you know, the child is not allowed to have fantasy, has to learn arithmetic, has to learn reading. All those processes come in which sever the ego from the self. As they say, I don't think it has to be as dramatic as it is in our public education. I think Montessori, for example, tries to keep the ego enveloped in touch with the self. Anyway, regardless, the development of the ego is at the expense of the self. You adapt to reality. You may be an artist, but you got to learn your math tables. You may be an artist, but you got to learn to read, things like that. Now, so there's a sense that the development of the ego separates from the self. Then, at midlife, that's how Jung classically put it, but that is not true anymore, I don't think. Sooner or later, if you've really got somebody to be down here, you start rebuilding the link. That's what dream work is. You can say each dream is a little piece of the self, reorienting your ego to who you really are. And you're, I think, following Neumann uses that term, the ego self axis. That we try to become the person we were born to be. And so there's a sense, then, that the ego starts taking on the characteristics of the self. However, it is always separate from the self. And it's a point of danger that the ego, in bringing up parts of the self and reorienting itself to who we really are, starts acting like the self. That's an inflation. So the ego gets, everybody uses the word Christified, because often the self is symbolized by Christ. Or by images of divinity, you start becoming and living in the world through your talents, through your gifts, through what you have to offer, through what your skills are, your basic fundamental needs are, more than when there's a split. So we're going to see the time he talks about. Am I in the self versus self in me? Well, that's because he's not clear how this axis works. At times he'll say, well, you've got to separate yourself. Well, you do at one phase of development. So all the things that he says would seem contradictory resolve when you realize it's a process with different characteristics at different steps along the way. And this ironic similarity between ego and self on the one hand, and yet difference between ego and self on the other. And if you can keep that in mind, the pieces that he mentions here will sort themselves out.
Question in German, the translation here is often I for ego.
Yeah.
And in German, it's ich, right?
Yeah.
Is there a word ego in German that Freud and Jung use? Is that an artificial construction?
That's a good question, Carl. I think it's the same ego. I'll check on that. But I think it's the same.
Do they use that word, or do they always use itch?
He's reading the book right now. Let's see, where does he use ego? The beginning of Scrutinies, right?
Well, I mean, I don't know what's being translated and what is not.
I hear you, Carl. I don't know. They might say Das Ich. I'll have to check. I'm just not sure.
Because it almost gives us in English an artificial construction.
Yeah.
If they don't really use it.
Yeah.
Classical psychology.
Right. That's a good question. I'm trying to think what I have in German. I think I have memories in German. I can see if I can compare the two. Yeah, you could just substitute the word I for ego. But
we don't tend to do that.
No, and you know, maybe there is a value in that. The problem is when we say I in colloquial speech, that I wouldn't necessarily correspond to what we mean by ego. I learned all this stuff at one time. I forget what you're supposed to say about what the ego means, but here's how I look. When you have done something and you haven't anticipated the result, there's no ego there. I remember one, nobody you would know, artist did a rather pornographic set of pictures, which was fine. I mean, it wasn't anything you wouldn't see in New York, but Hoosiers didn't go for it. Well, hello. And this artist was terribly upset that these people would not appreciate the art. Well, anyone who knows the Midwest mentality knows this is a prudish place. So I'm not saying that she shouldn't have done that art, but to be shocked that it was rejected means she didn't anticipate the consequence. That's a lack of ego. The other thing that I this is the world according to Gary, that I look at is, can the person see contradictions? I'll give you an example, a horrible example. You know, my friend Cynthia, who's doing a residency in psychiatry, was telling me she had a mom come in with, I think, a 9-year-old girl. She's doing a fellowship in child psychiatry. And I won't go into all the details unless you're interested, but the girl's been scapegoated, clearly. And the mother walked in and railed at the girl for being a fuck up, and irresponsible, and unreliable, and the worst example was recently she got some books from the library and she lost them. So Cynthia discussed and then gave the girl something to do. The mother turned to her and said, "You know, I may have thrown them out." See, that's not seeing split. There's no ego there. Now you might say, she might say, "Well, I said," but see, there's no I there at all. So what ego does, it gives us a way of looking at, is the person responsible and anticipating with reason that it's within our capacity what follows from our actions? Can we see our splits, our contradictions? I think the classic definition, the ego has identity, continuity, and something else. So identity is kind of nebulous, but continuity would mean schizophrenics who are Jane today and Mary tomorrow. There would be an absence of ego. But, you know, we generally don't work with people at that level of dysfunction in our kind of work we do in our homes. I'd be careful about letting them in my home. But so I look for not seeing contradictions and not seeing consequences, not being able to anticipate consequences. So that might be the value, Carl, of using that word ego.
It assumes a certain level of awareness.
Yeah, yeah.
That you could just say an I might not. When the child says I, at the beginning, not.
Yeah. You can even see that in a child because they'll start saying me. Mm-hmm. Me want. And then when they start saying I want, that's the ego.
They say, like my son used to say, Brooks doesn't like that. Or then, you know.
Right.
And you know there's something there.
Yeah.
Carl, I Googled it and it's das Ich for ego. That's what Google Translate
is. Is it?
Beginning to wonder, yeah. So we have this sort of extra distinction that we can make in English.
And it didn't capitalize it, which surprised me because it's a noun.
They should have capitalized
it.
All nouns are capitalized.
Yeah.
It's just Google Greek, right?
Yeah.
Well, I'll check. That's a good question. The other thing that that's all. I'll just mention it. what the translators have translated as sex, I think Freud says eros. The repression of eros, not the repression of sex, which is different. Now, I don't know. I don't know about either of those, for sure. But I can check on the ego.
And you said the ego is continuity, something?
This is a standard. This is, Jung just takes it straight from psychiatric literature. I think continuity, identity, maybe a responsibility, but I'm not sure. There's three terms that you'll find in textbooks. But I find it helpful to look at, is the person seeing consequences and do they see their contradictions?
So a person without ego identity would be one who essentially is so childlike, whatever their age, that they just, they will follow along with anything.
Yeah. Activity. Thank you. I think the third is activity, Carl. Activity, continuity, and identity.
So could we conclude from continuity that they're delineated, that there's a border there, that there's an edge, that they know, like with a child, they learn, you know, this is me, this is you, and that's a nebulous thing early on, and then they start to learn that. And so that's a process that we're constantly going through as we grow up.
I think my friend has got this 5-year-old. She said they were in Whole Foods and a little 5-year-old threw out his eat. I am 51. Said, now, why did you say that? Well, because I'm hungry. You didn't feed me. And the mom said, well, you've eaten twice today. The girl said, oh, I forgot. See, there's no ego there. I mean, she really did forget. There's no continuity between events. Isn't that cute, though?
That's wonderful. I have a relative who does that.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah, well, you see that in dementia.
They start losing their boundaries.
And that one thing follows from another, mm-hmm. And memory. Memory might be another part of that, Carl, in terms of the classical.
I'll keep adding.
Yeah.
And we're obviously talking here about the ego that is starting to, or has differentiated itself from the self. This is what we're...
Yeah, I think technically you shouldn't call it an ego unless it is differentiated from the self. So what we'd say is the ego is in the self in potential.
So as you step back, make more connections with the self, say, in life, you lose some of these hard-bound connections, identity, activity, memory.
Well, you should regain them.
No, they should become clearer, shouldn't they? This is who I really am. This is what I meant to do. So the edges become clearer to you, and the effect of the collective sort of fades away, and you get a clarity of who you are.
If you're in therapy, or if you're really conscious.
Right.
But I would say for a lot of adults, they go from, not a lot maybe, I don't know, but for some people, they go from childlike ego self. Some of them stay there forever. Some of them go to ego and then back to childlike without ever.
That's kind of what I was saying. The natural momentum would be to slide back into the self. And, you know, that's why they accuse older people of returning to childhood.
Yeah, absolutely. I think this is what originally myth and ritual was to fight against, but we don't have myth and ritual effective anymore. So therapy has to come in and substitute for it.
When you brought up me and I, you're reading that book, Eros, by this wonderful poet, and she talks about the introduction of language, and I'm just wondering if the introduction of language brings that consciousness about.
The, yes.
You know, the alphabet. Like she talks about, you know, she talks about how, and she's an ancient Greek specialist. So she talks about the difference between an oral tradition and then written word and the effect that it has on human consciousness and one's sense of self. Mainly, being a poet, she's very interested in, you know, Greek, ancient Greek poets. And so she studies those poets prior to whatever little snippets that they have and those poets after, what she calls the lyric Greek poets. And the book is all about Eros. And so she says that, you know, the whole process of bringing information when it's oral, when it's through the ears only, it has a whole different effect on the brain and one's sense of self. Because when you're in a group of people and they're performing, you know, a Greek play or whatever the traditions were back then, that's a collective experience. But once written word came about and you could read and study on your own, it solidified a sense of self for the Greeks. And so what she's seeing in the ancient Greek poetry is their experience of Eros coming in, which is Eros loosens boundaries, but it also widens one's sense of self, according to her, is they see that as an attack, these early poets, on their sense of self that they have worked so hard to gain.
The poets who worked in the oral tradition.
The poets who now are working in the written tradition.
Oh.
And the whole idea of being able now to study in solitude and to find a sense of self in that and not have to have a collective experience. Now you can have an experience of those myths and stories that's very personal to you.
Let me make sure, I'm not sure I followed you. So that the poets working in oral tradition, as they move into the written tradition, feel the written tradition as an attack.
They feel Eros, to fall in love, that sense of Eros, they write about it as poison, evil, because she feels that they felt it was an attack on their sense of self that they had gained from moving into the written language.
That makes perfect sense. So what's happening, if we go compare our two models, I think, with the birth of written language, you've got the ego separated from the self. Mm-hmm. And anything from the self is felt as an attack. Mm-hmm. That's why Greek tragedy is, it's all about love. And it always ends badly.
Yeah.
The ego is so fragile.
When you say it felt as an attack on their sense of self, we aren't using the self in quite the same way that we're using it up here. We're talking about more of a sense of
ego identity away from the collective, and you have to be very careful. She doesn't quote Jung at all. She brings Freud into it. Ann Carson, are you familiar with her?
No.
And it's called Eros, the Bittersweet, and apparently Sappho was the first poet to use that that word to describe Eros.
Bittersweet.
Mm-hmm. And it's an interesting book.
It fits because if the self is collective, and then if you go to the ego, it is like pulling yourself away and become a person instead of being. That's fascinating.
Sappho's era, that was still under written, right?
No, they have some snippets, but they have some snippets that were written down. And she's translated quite a few of them. Other people have as well. Who's that guy?
Klein.
Yeah.
But
later,
I mean,
He's on the
He's
Klein.
Anyway, he has all these translations that you can download. He said, as long as you don't, you know, you give me credit and you don't use them for your own profit.
So really, I think
is this what you're, what that's all saying is, if this is being differentiated, separated, it's also growing at that other state. It's also growing in its capacity to know itself and become more than what it has been. Its identity is enlarging
right.
as it goes relating to the self.
Yeah. But until that axis is established, then the ego does feel threatened by the self. But as the ego is established, I wouldn't say it's not threatened, but it's like, okay, here we go again. I'll sort of get on this roller coaster. Where prior to that, it's, oh my God, I can't stand the waves. Who's that guy in Marin County? He's written all his books. Kind of pop. He's a surgeon, but he's written. Shalane. He's got a whole book out. Oh, these bastard patriarchs who brought in language and, you know, let's just.
Yeah, and it is about the alphabet. So
the alphabet and the goddess, isn't it? Uh-huh. Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah.
When the alphabet came in, then the goddess kind of went out.
Yeah.
That's just
right. Well, and what she's saying, you know, when we talked about at lunch, is with the Greek language, they were the first to really bring in these vowels. So, you know, they had the Sumerian cuneiforms and the hieroglyphics at that time, which was a written language, but the Greeks were the first ones to bring vowels into the whole picture. So you had consonants, she said, as the delineators. Those are the masculine.
Mm.
And then, you know, the vowels are very feminine. Feminine kind of gets lost in the middle there. But it's very philosophical stuff that she's talking about.
It's absolutely practical, too.
It's very interesting.
I learned it from this class, I'm thinking that this French psychiatrist, Jacques Lacan, I don't care for him, but one of the things he said was interesting, that when a child sees itself in the mirror up to a certain age, I think one, it can't distinguish between its image and its mother's. So it's the same, but when it begins to distinguish its image from the mother in the mirror is when language starts. So again, it's a separation. And so what we're calling ego self is also parent child, is also historical epoch versus historical epoch. They're all parallel. Yeah. Okay. That's good stuff, yeah, because I don't know if you follow academic literature. this is really discussed, because the whole postmodern world, is what they call themselves, is really kind of hostile to thought. And it just shows for me it's a weak ego. Okay, so the God appears to us in a certain state of the soul. Now, for each of these sentences, I think what we've got to do is retranslate. Because the soul, in later formulation, would be the animal. But he hasn't got that clear yet. So, don't get all hung up in his words.
Okay.
Look behind the words for how they're grasping to express something he hasn't been able to conceive of yet, but which is different from ordinary understandings of the human being.
Those first two sentences.
Yeah, they make no sense.
No, right.
Therefore, we reach God through the self.
Right.
Now, he's going distinguishing between God and the self here. Later, he doesn't make that distinction because he says we can't know God. We've talked about this. We can only experience God or the God image. And the God image and the self are the same.
You think he's talking about Purusha and Atman here?
He could be. He could be. But in In later work, Purusha would be the inner divinity, Atman would be the outer divinity. And for the Indians, one is the smaller picture of the other, for Hinduism. And I don't think he quarreled with that at all. But he subsumes all of that under aspects of the self. It's the nature of the self that it's depicted by images of God, and that's as close as we can get to the question of God. And there appears to be an aspect of the self that is personal and a part of it that is not personal. That we are plugged into a bigger identity process that has, I would say, a historical dimension. And we are particularizations of that.
That seems to be what exactly what he's saying right here.
Yes, it's just his language.
Mm-hmm. When he says state of the soul, I just thought he meant like in despair. You usually don't sit and listen to a God or a dream.
I think that's...
You're really hurting.
That is certainly a valid angle. Mm-hmm. You know, we can, your opinion is...
And well, I'm just, I mean, later on he says it's the heaviest wound. It's from our sicknesses.
Right.
We search because of our...
Yeah, I think the best we can do here is put our heads together and try to get a big picture. Because they're highly ambiguous statements. But remember, he's grasping. That makes perfect sense, Jane. So, you know, not the self is God, although we reach the God through the self. Now, he would never say that later on. The God is behind the self, above the self, and the self itself when he appears. So, you know, in a sense, where he talks about the two being equal, I would say he's feeling at a certain... What he's given expression to is the fact that at a certain point, ego and self are united. At a later point, they're separated but united through our conscious efforts to realize the intention of the self. So that distinction hasn't been made yet.
So in one, it's being held within, say, in the state of the child, and then the other, it's a relationship.
Yeah.
Could we say there's a self-God axis as well? You have the ego self.
No. I mean, he excused metaphysical speculation.
Okay.
And this is a hard thing to get straight. But for him, is there a God is not a valid question. Because we cannot know the infinite.
We can only know that God image.
We can only know our experience of what we call God. Does that mean there is a God? How would I know, he says. The Christian would say, well, I have faith. Jung says, I'm not interested in faith. I'm interested in science. That's the breakdown between Jung and theology. He's trying to stay in the bounds of empiricism. If you want to use the big word, within the framework of phenomenology. Interested in the experience, not what lies behind it. Big difference. This surely gets the Christians upset. But my response to them is, what does it matter? The important question is, what is the self asking of you? What is this experience asking of you? Are you responding to it? It doesn't matter where it comes from. It may come from an objective God. It may not. But it is asking for your development to proceed in a certain way and for you to engage the world in a certain way, and that's the important thing. And what cracks me up about all these Christians, they argue about Jung being psychologizing religion, and then you see what they do with the dream of the self, which is run away. So, in my mind, because they're unable to come to terms with what this experience is asking of them, which you can observe in the dream, they harp on the fact that Jung does not want to say there is a real God. He's not saying there is, he's not saying there isn't. Now, personally, I think he was a believer. But he's trying to present this in a language that is consistent with science and consistent with ecumenical thinking. Because that gives validity to Muhammad, that gives validity to the Indian concept. All religious experience is valid. No one is more valid than the other because it has metaphysical validity.
I always remember that interview when the guy asked me, do you believe in God?
Yeah.
I believe. Now why? I know. Hey,
right. You're right.
And I just thought that to me summed it all up.
And I can tell you, that changed my life. I was in graduate school, and I went to see face-to-face. I was like a second year in graduate school. I didn't know what I was going to do with my life. I had discovered and was reading a little bit of Jung, and I was just looking for something to sink my teeth into, and I saw that, and I thought, okay, you son of a bitch. I'm going to see if you make good on that. And he does. And this is how. The phrase I have come up with to confound the theologians is he replaces metaphysical certainty with ethical obligation. That's the important. Are you setting about establishing that axis and taking the self's plan into the world?
And replaces what?
Metaphysical certainty with ethical obligation. Yeah, I told you that dream of the priest. I mean, it's so obvious. He liked Jung, but, you know, Jung psychologizes religion, all the stuff that you hear, and then he had the dream of witnessing. No, this is a guy here. Some of you heard this before, that he was to witness the resurrection of Christ. This was his dream in therapy. And Christ was brought in the casket, and the crucified Christ was brought in, and the lid opened, and Christ arose, and she was a beautiful woman, and she wanted to make love, and he ran, and he terminated. I saw him a year later. He was dying of a degeneration of his blood vessels. See how serious that is? So what's it matter if that's what it is? Something is being asked of you. And I think that's Jung's contribution to theology. We're asking the wrong questions. What we need to ask is what is being asked of us. We talked a little bit on Saturday where I have said that for me, God is the question that addresses me.
And Jung says, conversely, I am a question to the world that I must answer.
That I must answer, yeah.
Otherwise, the world will answer it for me.
Yeah, exactly. We're each a question, mm-hmm. and we have to answer. And that's the religious task. And what another way of putting that is, that self is a question. It presents you with a question. What, first I think it's how do you develop within yourself? And then secondly, how do you take what you've developed and take it into the world, and what that amounts to is you've discovered what your question is, and you go about living it in the world, providing the answer. And, I think this was one of Jung's questions was that fate put to him, what's the nature of God? And this is his answer. And then individuation follows from it, and so on.
So you're living your answer.
Right.
Right.
Your life is the answer.
Your life is the answer to the question.
The way you live your life is the answer. Or your life is about providing the answer. My question is this relationship between science and spirituality. I mean, I have to deal with it. And you see how synchronicity starts cooperating with it once you've accepted it. It is a pain in the butt every time, you can be sure. But, yeah. No, Over to you.
So earlier you linked to this, what you, the concept, the idea of the axis, the self axis, which implies then that the axis is a conscious thing.
Yes.
There's no sense that the ego self axis is an unconscious thing.
I think it can be with good parenting. Or a natural thing. Now, I've told it many times, the story of Andrew Wyeth. Have you heard that, Carl?
No.
Bear with me, folks, who've heard it. Andrew Wyeth lived near me in Pennsylvania, so I've always been interested in him. And I saw an interview with him, and his dad was N.C. Wyeth, the portrait painter for books. And the interviewer said, now, you're an artist, you're... sister's a pianist, and your brother's a mechanical engineer. How did three such different kids come out of the family? And he said, well, that's quite simple. It was my dad. As a little kid, I used to go into my dad's studio, and I'd play with his paintbrushes. My little sister would sit at the piano and bang on it. And so my dad said, well, I bet Andrew wants to be an artist, and I bet the sister wants to be a pianist. And my brother used to sit on his pram for hours and take the hubcap off and put it back on. He said, so my dad said, I bet he wants to be a mechanical engineer. See, the father saw that self and helped the child develop it. I think that's what good parenting is. Bad parenting is like that woman. Either you just belittle the child, or you say to the mechanical engineer, you should be an artist. Or to the artist, you should be a mechanical engineer. Then we go back and try to reverse that damage. Which, you know, in our generation, I just don't think our parents had the tools.
They still had all the Victorian crap.
Yeah. Victorian crap and social pressures. I want my son or my daughter to... Marry well, have a, you know, not have the rough life I had. My dad's, my grandfather was a coal miner. They wanted to get the hell out of West Virginia and make sure I got a good education, and which in a way is based on love, but it never says, who are you?
I read somewhere that it starts with the parent touching the child. And in that touching of the child, you say, you help them find their boundaries. This is who you are.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so through that personal touch that a parent gives a child, and then that continues and grows from there by seeing what they're interested in, and that also is who you are or what you're capable of. So it does, I think, begin very, very early.
The body is crucial here.
By helping mirror back to the child, this is you, this is your boundary, and I'm this. And so many parents don't do that.
No.
Yes, seeing the child as separate, you know, and helping the child see himself as that separate.
Yeah, I was talking to somebody who is at one of those Pottery Barn stores. So. And a little girl was sitting in the car going, A, B, C, D, E, F, G, H, I, J, K, L, M, N, O, P. Get the Z, start over again. A, B, C, D, E, F, G. And the mother said, oh, Brandy, how you do, go on. See, she's killing that. The parent could have said, wow, it's so great to hear you learning the alphabet. Well, that's what's going on. This is not yet clear. And I think if you can keep the big picture in mind, you'll see each of these statements make sense in a certain context. We must heal ourselves from the God, since he is also our heaviest wound. So there I would go that when the ego has been established separately, the experience of the self is a wound. Because we are one thing, The self is another, and before we can begin to hear the self, our understanding of who we are has to be confused, so we start hearing the other voice. And often I think what looks like tragedy is the beginning, what looks like outer tragedy is the beginning of the connection with the self. That because we are out of sync with ourselves, we have collided with reality. And that collision upsets our certainty, and we're open to hear the alternative voice of the self. So often it starts in heartache. I don't think it has to, but often it does.
There's that article you sent me this week, the John article on, I have any quote about Woody Allen, but it talked about trauma and creativity.
Yeah.
It was a similar kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That through a trauma, one's true creative potential can be found. That most truly creative people have had some sort of trauma in their lives.
Yeah.
But Gary, also, could you say that if a person has an incredibly weak ego, they can be filled with the dark side of the self and just live that out? Kind of the whole Nazi, the people in Germany, all on, and then realizing later, like, I'd love that whole
what I do. Yeah, for this, according to the standard theory, the ego should separate from the self before turning back to the self. I think things have changed. And the demands of life are putting the necessity of selfhood on people far earlier, before the ego is separated. And I think it is possible to do both things at the same time. But it's more difficult. In other words, to separate the ego and relate it back to the self at the same time.
So do you think it's speeding up?
Yes.
As we move towards this switch in eras from Pisces to Aquarius?
Yes, I do. And I think just technology, the fact that the world's getting smaller, that the world is more competitive, that we are facing problems that have to be solved. Certainly, to creative young people, brings this on much earlier.
She was about 18.
Yeah.
Marie von Franz was 18.
Was 18. Yeah.
Yeah,
he invited her to Bali and they all got drunk.
Really?
Yeah.
By then, was she already proficient in all those ancient languages?
No, she was, I believe she was like what we would call a high school student, a gymnasium student, which goes to, I think, 20, and then they start the university, and she had originally planned to study medicine and had a dream, apropos your Greek interests, of a whole line of ancient Greeks filing past her, and she had to provide them with food. And so she decided to study classics instead.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But the story was that on their meeting that Tony Wolfe's nephew, I think, was a classmate of von Franz in the gymnasium, and Jung said, I don't know your generation, and invited through the nephew about half a dozen or a dozen young people to Bali, and she said, we all sat around and got drunk on Burgundy wine. And then she started attending his lectures, and he went up to her, and she was, you know, pleased that he showed interest. Friendship was established.
I can't help but thinking of that. In our Saturday class, I'm sorry, the picture of the bear that bothers you, you know, with the birth of the horse. I think this paragraph is definitely in my mind. The sickness and the healing.
Yeah.
Comes the healing.
Yeah.
Carol and I've been having a lot of discussion on that. I'm not sure we're ready to share.
Okay, when you're ready, let us know. Yeah, and I think the editor makes an interesting link to the fact that Jung says that what's happened to the gods is they've become diseases. That's another aspect of the wound. Mm-hmm. That we don't have a pantheon which in simple terms, would be a portrait of all our needs. All of these sides of ourselves have to be satisfied, and we just live on one or two of those needs, leaving the rest of them unsatisfied, and then that unsatisfied energy turns to sickness. That's another way to think of that disease, or that the self announces itself in the body as a problem. Well, like the guy with the blood vessels. I mean, he couldn't accept his passion. And the blood carriers started to disintegrate. So this business, the self is in God. The God is in the self. I am in the self. I am in God. That is all struggling, as I read it, to get clear. There's a sense in which one is contained, one is not contained, one is separate, one is linked to, depends on the part of the phase, and depends on how you understand in the God. When I am hearing the voice of the self and I am putting it into practice, there is a sense that I am in the self. But there's another sense that I'm separate from it. So that's how I understand all of this stuff. And then, you okay with that so far? Well, we've done two sentences in an hour. We're zooming along.
I mean, all this makes perfect sense in Jungian theory. I can just read this whole thing, and it just clicks.
Good.
I mean, I don't find it confusing.
Okay. Hence, when the God appears to us, we are at first powerless, captivated, divided. That all should make sense, no? Poisoned with the strongest poison, because it thwarts our intention for a while, but drunk with highest health. It is a portrait of our future healthy life. We cannot remain in this state, so then you have to serve your experience. A little further down, I'm on the first column, 339. And so we strive to free the self from the God. We would say now, free the ego from the self.
You wouldn't say free the God image from the God?
No.
Mm-hmm.
No, I wouldn't. Because for him, there's no difference.
So to free the self from, say, the God image, does that mean that we have to free the part of us that's contained within that?
No, see, that would be a nonsensical statement down the road.
Okay.
Free the self from the God image. Okay. This God image is the self.
Okay.
We have to free our ego from the self/God image. Now, the only way you might justify that statement, as I understand it, Carol, is from our concept of God.
Mm-hmm. Or, exactly.
Yeah. That I could understand.
Or from the idea that there's some sort of metaphysical thing that we can identify.
Yes, and then I could, and then I'm with you.
Mm-hmm. And that is sort of like that image in the Saturday class of him with the lightning bolt.
Absolutely.
Yes. And the enormity of that God image in that painting.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, and it also wouldn't be that his daughter's describing you have to become strong against the God. You have to make your stand, and you're trying to stand against him or her. And to me, that would be, that might start out as a more of a parent-child, but then as you grow in that, you would be more of an adult, to take that language, a bar from it. So that really just take free yourself, but separating out as adult or adult would be the later stages of that, right?
Yeah, just thinking that you're talking, he might, sorry about this, girl, but you might get Windows on Eternity if you want to have the slightest idea what we're talking about. It's Berkhuser. He might be an example where it was a spiral, separating out, reuniting, separating out, reuniting. It wasn't, oh, we're establishing ego, and then we go back to the self.
That doesn't happen. Does it like that? Isn't it always a spiral? Isn't it always a, I mean, if you think about dream work, it's one step forward, and sometimes it might be a little step back, and then you make more headway. And it
certainly was that way for me.
It's more of a spiral. My experience has been more of a spiral.
But I have seen people who are phenomenally successful in the outer world.
Okay.
Executives, you know, managers, people whose whole life has been managing the external world, and they are completely separate. The world just pulled them away from themselves. So there, it's not a spiral. It's a slow return. But I certainly, you know, I was, what, 25 when I started this. My ego wasn't developed. And it is a spiral. I think we have to remember there are almost as many variations as there are individuals. But we make these little schemas.
Okay, so going back to that image,
he is holding
a thunderbolt,
right,
which reminded me of Zeus.
Yeah.
So if we think that this big image that he's that him is the ego, and that picture, whatever it is, as the self, he's taken a little
right
bit of that into himself, and
right,
that's why he can have the strength to separate.
That's right.
Yeah.
It's ironic that the self supports the separation of the ego from itself on the one hand,
right,
and fights it with everything on the other. Absolutely true. So what we're trying to do in therapy, particularly with people in that spiral process, is side with that part of the self that supports the separation. And I think then the self helps the ego develop, and one can develop the ego and relink to the self at the same time. Probably more in creative people. But when it's a young person comes into therapy, which is not that often, when I say young, you know, late teens, something like that, they're probably creative. Or they'd be out playing football.
So when you said God, the God that becomes Jesus.
Yeah.
So this is the God image. This is the part that we can take from the self and heal.
Yeah. If the self can't make itself known through to the ego, it makes itself known through the body. So each of those diseases is like a dream. And it's trying to get to us that way. That's essentially Marianne Woodman's work. That's what I learned from her. Jung talks about it, but she takes it and expands it.
She lived
it. And she lived it.
Nice to see where we are there.
How we got there. I think it's very fascinating. Well, let's take a stretch. We've already done three paragraphs. Time to take a break.